By now, you've quite possibly gotten used to having a cell phone on you or near you for most of the day, and just look around you and notice the flat spot in the back pocket of many people's pants where they stash the phone when it's not in use, which is not often. We have grown very dependent on our electronic devices, and we are changing as a result. So says our guest this hour. Doreen Dodgen-McGee is the author of the book Deviced, Deviced with an exclamation point, subtitled Balancing Life and Technology in a Digital World. Doreen is a psychologist in private practice in Portland. She gets out in public plenty with a blog and an Instagram account and a fair amount of public speaking here and abroad. Thank you for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you so much. I'm really honored to be here.
We should be clear up front, Doreen, you are not tech averse. How would you describe your approach?
In fact, I really, really enjoy and appreciate tech and the many wonderful and beautiful things it provides for us. I am all about us being aware and informed about the research, both around the positive effects that it has on our lives and the less than positive effects it has on our lives, and thinking about how we might moderate our technology use by balancing it with a rich and interesting and very active embodied life.
Embodied life, meaning not in your devices, something that you live in the real world and can touch and smell and
correct.
All that stuff.
Correct.
You have a PhD in human development, and I wonder if your view of tech and our interactions with it has changed since tech first began appearing on the scene and we had, you know, the flip phones and stuff like that.
That was the impetus of my interest, in that when my own children, who are now young adults, were in middle school, flip phones were beginning to enter the scene, and I was watching the way in which these small devices that really could only send words and voice messages were beginning to interrupt social engagement between children. And at the same time, my husband was working in high tech and talking about smartphones and what they would be like, and I began to become very curious and started kind of looking at the pop culture trends as well as and alongside of the academic research at that point, so that I could kind of be an early observer of what even subtle changes we might see. And over time, that has become almost more than a part-time job, because the research cycle is so slow that it's just now beginning to really bring forth some of the really important trends that I think are important for all of us to become aware of. So I do see these as great and important tools, as I did early on, and I'm a little more skeptical about our full-scale adoption of them.
Now, as much as you talk about this, research it, work on the issues of people and devices, you say that you resisted writing this book. Why?
I really am a big believer in embodied experience, and I would much rather be a person in an embodied space with another person having the complex conversation around technology. It's just so easy to fall into the trap of becoming shaming or judgmental or authoritative, rather than really doing the hard work of becoming very nuanced and complex. And so I did have this fear, number one, that I would be just another voice that sounds like I'm saying, put down your tech, and not being understanding of how really to function in our world anymore. We need to be able to use it well. I also know that the speed at which tech is developed is so fast that I really feared that a book, you know, in black and white print would be out of date by the time it came to the popular press. And so what I was able to do is really avoid talking about specific platforms or even specific tech developments, and instead to talk about just how this new, shiny, beautiful, potential rich field of devices, it can also have four areas of profound effect, which are neurologically, interpersonally, and also just intrapersonally, the way in which we think about and develop a relationship and work from a relationship from a solid sense of self, and then also how they are impacting just the way that we experience our own embodied worlds.
So obviously positive and negative here. You seem convinced that we at least learn more about ourselves as humans from our exposure to the devices.
We do learn about ourselves as humans. However, I find that there is kind of this shift that has occurred, that rather than having this or living from what I call an internal locus of control, which is an ability to kind of check in with ourselves, to both soothe ourselves and stimulate ourselves, to motivate ourselves, instead often we are now looking outside of ourselves for motivation, for drive, for affirmation, for relationships, and we are getting that through our devices. And I think that does create a profound shift in that we now live in a time where we are kind of ambiently aware of being constantly observed and judged and evaluated and weighed in on. And I do think that has a pretty profound effect on the way we relate to our own selves.
Doreen, you warn us up front in the book about statistics. Are stats about device use suspect?
Great question. Yes, I think all statistics and all research should be approached from a suspect point of view, meaning it isn't enough to just read statistics say or research claims. We must always be ready and willing and capable, have some good tools with us to be able to evaluate and really critically look at any research that is presented to us. It is more important than ever now that so many of the companies that track our clicks have much more accurate, in terms of real-time statistics, they have more accurate research than maybe some of the peer-reviewed research might be. However, we don't always know that their studies or the way in which they present their research is really ethically sound or even statistically significant. And so it's very important that we not just take a claim as truth and run with it, but that we do a little bit of digging and a little bit of critical analysis and a little bit of research analysis to make sure that what we're presented with is really actually ethically sourced information.
We'll explore more of the effect that tech can have on us and the ways in which things change when we don't have an embodied experience but have one through our devices instead. Doreen, we talk often in tech about age, gender, and socioeconomic divides. You find some of these to be true and some not at all?
True. I do find that the socioeconomic divide is very real and that we are now seeing a reality in our country where some of the most wealthy and privileged individuals are choosing to send their children to a school system or school systems that don't involve much tech because they're beginning to see some of this negative impact, especially on cognitive growth and focus abilities. And yet some of our least privileged citizens don't have those same kinds of choices. And I do see over time this creating kind of divide that is going to be a very difficult one to overcome and a really unfortunate one to have settled. Also, I find a lot of people just kind of in a knee-jerk way do talk about tech as a generational issue or as a gender issue. And those things I don't find to be as true anymore. Oftentimes, the people who are slowly adopting are the ones who are the most egregious offenders in social settings. You know, oh, I saw this meme, and they pull their phone out. And so even though it's a small kind of micro, infringement of social norms, it is still one. And so I always find it's important to kind of break down any of those preconceived ideas we've had and start with ourselves and become aware of the way that we use tech in ways that could interrupt social exchanges or meaningful relational exchanges and start there from those, again, those non-shaming places. It is also really important, especially for grown people in the lives of children, to understand that tech use is not more common amongst boys or that, you know, girls aren't going to be drawn there. This is really an equal opportunity space anymore, and both boys and girls find great and wonderful things in online spaces and also some pretty tricky ones.
Yeah, no doubt about that. We'll get into those in detail in a bit. You propose retiring an acronym, IRL, in real life. Why?
I just find anymore that the experiences that we have in our digital spaces very much impact our embodied ones and vice versa. We purchase things in online spaces and they arrive, you know, in three dimensions at our door. We have meaningful relational exchanges in, again, these tech spaces that very much impact our embodied spaces. And I think it's just one more way that we kind of make an issue binary that isn't necessarily binary. It isn't all good. It isn't all bad. It isn't all real versus all digital. It's all very much a part of our very complex embodied experience. And I feel like it's time that we become very, very honest with ourselves about that.
There's a couple of points that you bring up that are somewhat more filigreed. They're finer detailed points. You know, they're things we talk about, like, you know, people playing video games and all that stuff. Those are the big things. But you get into things like how we don't things we don't have to do anymore because of our digital devices, like, for example, remember phone numbers. And there's a reference you put on this that you call something in this process leaking. Leaking in what sense?
It's a great question. I love that you noticed that in the work. I talk about leaking in the concept of relational kind of satisfaction and awareness. And oftentimes when I am speaking with individuals, specifically around things like social media and the way that technology fills in the gaps for us relationally, we all, I believe very much that humans have a strong drive to connect. And we maybe work that out in very different ways amongst the many of us. There are many ways of doing that. However, at the end of the day, we do have this strong sense to belong or to be known or to be seen. And what places like social media or even gaming, where we're gaming with a clan or a community of similar-minded people, do is they offer us these opportunities to get little kind of little snippets of connection throughout the day, normally around either this shared activity or this shared space that we are existing within. And this leaks off little bits of our desire or our need to be known and be seen. However, at the end of the day, when we are just ourselves with ourselves, really not in a way where we are curating anything to post online or performing for anyone else in such as something like a gaming space, we do have that desire that, can I even be seen and known and accepted and belong even in that space where I am just my most me at the end of the day, not performing? And when we have kind of leaked off little bits of that desire to be known and to belong, we kind of get this false sense of fullness. I liken it to if our stomach is very empty and growling, we can down a bottle of water very quickly and our stomach feels full, it stops growling. But very quickly, we will realize we don't have any calories with which to perform the functions of the day. We've just kind of faked ourselves into feeling full. And I think that's oftentimes what online connection can feel like. It feels like we're getting our relational needs met, but really at the very end of our time online or when we go offline, we don't know if we really have those relationships or are seen or known in such a way that kind of gives us this gritty sense that we have a community that's really there for us. And I think I just hear this more and more as time goes on.
This is the Jefferson Exchange. Our guest is Doreen Dodgen McGee, a Portland psychologist. Her book is Deviced, Balancing Life and Technology in a Digital World. So we're getting a lot of validation from our devices that we used to get from people in person. Are we not seeking out the in-person, the embodied experiences, as you put it?
I think not only are we not seeking them out, but our world is not structured anymore to provide natural opportunities for them. You know, even the small social practice of walking up to a counter and ordering a meal or a coffee drink and then paying for it and taking it out of the shop is a social practice experience that's important. And we now, as we offload more and more of those experiences to being able to order online, pay for something online, pick it up at a separate counter and never have human interchange, I think all of those kinds of things really are robbing us from the opportunity to develop a proclivity of relational kind of capability and, you know, the ability to tolerate awkward moments. And so when we have less of the practice or the habitual opportunities for that, we oftentimes then avoid them and we create this cycle where we're not as comfortable in those spaces, so we don't seek them out, so we stay less comfortable, and it kind of cycles from there.
So when we get into situations too, I mean, when we talk about, you know, talking to other people, relating to other people, it gets into deep stuff. I mean, you're suggesting here, it seems that we even lose healthy sexuality through the use of devices.
I do think that is a very huge risk anymore, especially as we have more and more opportunities, again, for giving ourselves approximate sexual experiences that feel very real because they engage the emotional centers of our brain. So they feel like actual real experiences, but they are in a digital space without real embodied others. So yes, we are seeing a higher incidence of sexual dysfunction than we've ever seen, and at younger ages than we've ever seen it, because of the way that we now can have these kind of less less messy, more you know, jump in, jump out kinds of sexual experiences than we've ever been able to have in the past.
Is there, I mean, sexuality aside, is there a lessening of all sensation when we get so much from our screens?
I really believe that there is. I believe that when we are only stimulating, you know, a couple of our senses, our sense of sight and our sense of sound, that just by virtue of the fact that we only have 24 hours in a day, if we increase the amount of time we're spent stimulating just two of those, the others kind of do lack attention. And so one of the things that I am deeply excited about talking with people about is making sure that they are, you know, stimulating the other senses, that they're stimulating their sense of smell and of touch and of taste, that they are making sure that they put themselves in the way of real beauty in embodied spaces and real awkwardness also, in order to develop grit and resilience, which are two psychological constructs that are on the decline, but that we really need to live kind of a contented, successful life.
You offer some ideas for cultivating the senses, and among them is the idea of cherish silence. How hard is that for some people now?
It is so challenging. I used to, in my talks, I would always talk about the research that shows that 10 minutes a day of mindfulness meditation can double the gray matter in the regions of the brain that appear to be kind of experiencing some pruning as a result of our tech use. And that was fine and good, but the thing that always came up after the talks was, okay, you said that we should do this 10 minutes, but I have no idea how to sit for 10 minutes and be mindful. And I think that's really true. You know, the more that life has not continued to offer us opportunities to be bored or to be silent, we don't tend to think about creating those opportunities. And anymore, we really must if we're going to face them. And so if we could even do something small, like put a different object in the pocket where our phone usually lives, in our purse or in our pants, you know, a journal or a small flat stone, so that when we reach for our device, we find this other object and we think, oh, maybe I could just be quiet and still with this for 3 minutes or for 4 minutes. Unless we do things like that, we really aren't likely to be forced to face silence or this kind of mindful space as we have been in the past.
You certainly get into some of the physiological effects that we get. I mean, if we're sitting with our devices for long periods, there's the basic danger that comes with sitting for any reason. There's the posture that we get from bending over our phones as we walk down the street. You do get into the blue light aspect of the screens, too. And there are certainly some physiological effects, too. But as you report, there are also some effects on moods. Can you unpack those?
I can. So the blue light that comes from our devices is very similar to the light that comes from what we would call a mood light or a seasonal affective depression light, the kind of light that gives the brain the opportunity to have exposure to the form of light that stimulates the release of neurotransmitters related to mood regulation. So when we hold our small devices right next to our faces, it's a little bit like holding one of those mood lights right near our eyes, which will then stimulate the release of neurotransmitters in the brain that tell us to be awake and alert and happy. And what's a concern to many folks in this realm is that we're doing that frequently when we're in bed and we're trying to find a way to bring our bodies to a restful state for sleep. But instead, we're actually telling our brain to wake up and be kind of alert and happy. And so this is just one of the many side effects of the exposure to blue light that we see now.
Well, then let's go straight to the what happens to our brains on tech. It seems like everybody and her dog have been scanned in fMRI devices. That's functional MRI. So, I mean, are our brains showing some differences from prolonged use of screens?
They are, and it's really tricky to know, you know, again, hearkening back to your early questions about research, it's difficult to look at the research and know which studies are really well constructed and aren't. But generally, what we can say with a lit review is that the brain does appear to be changing. And the thing that we know about neurological wiring is that where the brain fires together, it wires together, meaning where the brain is stimulated, and it's especially stimulated repeatedly, wiring will occur that will create a proclivity within the brain to handle whatever the brain has been exposed to. And it seems as though we are exposing the brain to fewer and fewer opportunities for boredom, for stimulation from one thing at a time, so focus, the ability to focus, and the ability to kind of regulate or bring the brain and the endocrine system and the body to a state of kind of calm. And so as we offer the brain opportunity to be exposed to fewer of those opportunities, we create less and less wiring. Neurologists will call that pruning. So if we aren't asking the brain to function in a certain way, that region of the brain kind of gets pruned off to wiring. So it looks as though generally the prefrontal cortex, which is the region that's responsible for attuned communication, for focus, for the ability to start and stop behaviors, as well as for a lot of other important functions for the brain, does appear to be experiencing some pruning. The good news is that we have neuroplasticity, which means we can rewire parts of the brain that have been pruned off. However, that's where we get into the really difficult task now of then exposing ourselves to experiences that are very uncomfortable and that we don't have maybe a natural proclivity toward anymore. And that's where it's very hard. So for young children, for instance, who haven't been asked to focus, who have instead been faced with a lot of screen exposure where there are constantly changing images on the screen, constantly changing sounds coming from the screen, and now they're put in a classroom with one teacher, they literally don't have the neurological proclivity to be able to focus on one thing at a time. They become agitated, they become anxious, they don't know how to focus, they're very distracted. So it's possible for us to help them rewire that capability in the brain, but it's going to be more and more difficult the longer we let it go on.
Well, I guess I hadn't even thought about that part of it, that you're not offering in a classroom constantly changing pictures, and that's something
right.
that a lot of kids have gotten used to.
Right. It's really a tricky challenge. I have a lot of empathy for both those students and the teachers and parents.
Is boredom then, Doreen, useful to some people?
I think it is useful to everyone. I wish that I could invite the whole world to a boredom party where we just
didn't do nothing.
Curate. Yeah, exactly. We don't curate the guest list. We don't plan anything ahead of time. We just bring people together in such a way where we kind of have to struggle through the awkwardness of initial boredom, of not having a plan, of not being directed, and then finding out, you know, what is it that you could teach me and what useless skill do I have that could be fun for us to explore together? Or can we sit together and look at the clouds and be okay with silence? I do think that boredom is one of our only answers, and developing a proclivity to being able to handle and tolerate the discomfort that we experience there. And I'm not talking about large swaths of boredom to start with, but even 10 minutes a day that could, you know, be approximate to that 10 minutes of mindfulness that can, again, rewire that region of the brain could be hugely life-changing. And I've observed it be life-changing for people when they realize they can actually develop the skill of putting all their devices away, actually maybe powering them off for a short period of time, just to see what happens and to develop some kind of resilience and creativity around that time and space.
It does take creativity to make yourself not bored. And if you just get to pick up the device and go, okay, I'm going to go back to here. And I believe that's the voice in my head. I'm not insulting anybody.
I love it. You know, in my own home, I have a lot of, I have just everywhere on every coffee table and surface, I have different kinds of embodied things. I have a Tibetan singing bowl. I have Legos. I have little gyro wheels from the 50s that you can play with. And just yesterday, someone said, it really is true at your house. When I do sit down, I find something to pick up, and I'm less likely to pick up my phone. And I think just even attending to our embodied spaces in those ways where we have small things to keep our fingers and our minds busy can be a help in transitioning to creating and privileging some time that is not spent with tech.
We have more to talk about with Doreen Dodgen-McGee, psychologist in private practice in Portland. She is the author of Deviced, Balancing Life and Technology in a Digital World. So let's zero in a little closer on relationships, not only with others, but with ourselves as well. You talk about a difference between relational lives and social life. Can you expand on that, Doreen?
I can. So I think that we have always had, you know, both experiences, both a way that we are out and about in the world with others and then a way we are most deeply within ourselves. I think it's just easier now than ever to settle with that kind of social, how we present ourselves, view of ourselves rather than actually who we genuinely are. And I think there's a price we pay in that we always know that there is something about us, and this is true even offline or outside of digital spaces, but that there are things about us that we don't present. It's just more of an issue now in tech spaces where we can take, you know, 50 selfies and find the one that is the best angle and then apply a bunch of filters and put that online. And then when I know that people have sought out information about me online before they meet me in person, person. And so when I go out into the world as an embodied self, I know that I don't meet up to the self that I have curated. And I find over and over when I talk with individuals about how this really creates a very difficult reality for them, where they kind of they have to pause in a different way and try to square up how they've presented themselves versus who they genuinely are. And it does create a little bit of a rift in the way in which we create even embodied relationships.
So do you get things like, gee, I thought you were shorter or funnier or any, you know, something?
Often that. The place where I hear about this frequently is with new college students. So, you know, it used to be that you would be assigned a roommate and assigned a dorm floor, and you show up on that first move-in day and you kind
knowing
of
nothing
everybody.
About the person.
Right. And you create a reality together where you're all starting from this day of high nerves and unknowns, and everybody's kind of in this similar place. And now what happens, first of all, many universities are using a Tinder-like program now to choose roommates, where a student logs in and is just fed a never-ending stream of faces with a couple lines of profile, and they can either swipe right if they like the look of the person or swipe left if they don't, and they're matched in that way, which I have some issues with that because, you know, we're just now choosing roommates based on appearance and a couple of quippy lines of text. But then in addition to that, they have sought out or searched everyone on their dorm floor ahead of time and really gotten kind of a preconceived idea of who that person is based on their social media, which, you know, may or may not be any kind of an accurate representation of who this individual actually is. This is also a time in life where a lot of young adults really look for a fresh start and getting to kind of start with a clean slate. But now they come into those connections and relationships with this kind of preconceived idea. And it's really hard to undo those things. And it's hard to connect with actually the embodied others within our spaces. If we have a lot of information about who that person was before, we are likely going to relate to them out of that bias that we've created. Does that explain that?
It does. And it's not just a situation of what is out there about us, but also how other people respond to it. I mean, as we've talked about many times, and you know, it's a constant topic of discussion in society now, disinhibition online, the way that people really just go after each other. And so trolling is pretty much mainstream now. I mean, when people put stuff online, they expect people to attack it, don't they?
They do. They do. And I think that is so unfortunate because so many of our spaces that could have been spaces of real cognitive stretching and bias checking have really become unsafe spaces in terms of attack and personal defamation.
So what happens? This is an interesting thing you put in the book about how people who spend time in online zones of harsh judgment, what they notice when they pull back, when they come back to the embodied space.
Yeah, so what we know now from the research is that lots of exposure to violence in the media, which anymore I really believe that even very much time on Twitter is exposing oneself to violent media, does have a prolonged and lag effect, meaning that we don't see, yet anyway, we don't see a correlation between high exposure to violent media and criminal acts of violence, but we see very strong correlational relationships between exposure to violent media, meaning even relational violence and interpersonal violence in language, and soft forms of relational aggression, meaning high amounts of sarcasm, high amounts of critical language, profanity being used about individuals, and unchecked bias in the way in which we talk about other people. So when you have exposed yourself and you've become kind of immune to a lot of relational violence, you become more likely to perpetuate relational violence. And I think that's important for all of us to recognize.
I'm starting to get a hit that this is a bit like an abusive relationship, that you know, you stay in a relationship that isn't good for you because you love the person. I mean, you love the attention you get from your friends on the web, but you also have to put up with the abuse you get from people who don't like you or just want to make fun of you even if they do like you.
That's a really good analogy. That's a very good analogy, yes.
Wow, that's amazing. So let's talk about a couple of other facets here. Tech addiction, is it real?
Well, that depends on who you ask. Most other countries do have or do recognize tech addiction, gaming addiction, and social media addiction as, you know, as a codable kind of diagnoses that have treatable protocols that go along with them. In the United States, we do not. We do not see tech addiction or gaming or social media as formally addictive. The World Health Organization, however, has codified gaming addiction as an actual diagnostic category with, again, a protocol for treatment. And I think that what we can say is that there is certainly evidence in the research that the same kinds of addictive principles that exist with things like eating disorders do exist, or gambling disorders do exist with tech use, where the amount that we originally gain a certain level of high from or stimulation from quickly tops out and we need more exposure to receive that same kind of high. We also know that dopamine is involved, the release of dopamine in the brain is involved with certain forms of tech exposure at the same kind of rate and frequency as is related to drug use and, again, other forms of addiction. So I personally believe that probably we are in a state where, yes, addiction is very real. My bigger concern is that we begin to at least have medical professionals, psychological professionals, even faith leaders, educators, and parents begin to understand that dependency is very real. Even if we don't say addiction is real, dependency is real, and that there's a real cost we pay from offloading most of our embodied functions onto our online spaces, and that we need to become very, very honest with ourselves about the way in which that has happened for us and tell ourselves the truth about that, so that we can then also become responsible leaders and educators for the younger people around us. Because whether or not we as a culture name this as an addiction, we definitely are seeing diminished ability to focus, diminished ability to be emotionally regulated, and then the other effects just in terms of, like we've talked about, the brain, the posture, the eyes. And it's important that we become aware of this. And oftentimes I find in our culture, unless we code something as a diagnosable issue, we don't tell ourselves the truth about it. So I don't think we need necessarily to do that right yet, but we definitely need more therapists, pediatricians, and general physicians to become aware and start talking about this issue, because it is very, very real.
The returning to the embodied space, there's an interesting exercise you propose involving eye contact. What is that?
I really encourage people to make themselves uncomfortable some of the times. Again, exposing ourselves to awkwardness and discomfort, I think, is one of the best ways to make sure that we don't face some of the negative consequences of being really dependent upon our tech. So I just encourage people to find someone who would be willing to do a little experiment with them, and to sit in close proximity to each other and just make eye contact for whatever amount of time you feel like you can tolerate it. I suggest starting at 3 minutes and working up to 10. And to even intensify the experience, to not talk during the experience. And you will find yourself very likely laughing a lot early on and then kind of being able to settle into the experience. And it is typically a very profound experience for people. And they begin to realize things not only about the other, but also about their own internal world and experience in really interesting and profound ways.
All right. So the advice here is to continue having an embodied existence where you don't live entirely through the cyber world, but you actually see and touch and smell and taste things and touch other people and all that sort of stuff, rather than relying just upon the devices. So no surprise that Doreen Dodgen-McGee's book is called Deviced: Balancing Life and Technology in a Digital World. Doreen's a psychologist in private practice in Portland. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much. It's really, really an honor to be here.